Talk Back Gardening
with John Lamb
and Susie Ramone
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Yes, Susie Ramone filling in for Deb Tribe today. And good morning, John Lamb.
Good morning, Susie Ramone. It's lovely to have you in the studio with me rather than on the producer's side of things.
Yes, it's great because we have been working together a long time, well, decades really, haven't we, off and on. And even when I'm not working here, I'm always listening to Talk Back Gardening on the weekends and sometimes I'm taking notes. So, yeah, it's lovely to be here with you for Talk Back Gardening.
Very shortly we're going to talk to Darren Ray and I'll be interested to know whether we're in for a late spring and when is the time that the soil temperatures are going to be warm enough to put in the tomatoes? Will it be the long weekend in October, or maybe we might have to wait a little longer? Anyway, we'll talk to Darren shortly, because later in the program, for those gardeners that are trying to beat the vegetable high prices and growing their own, we'll find that there's a shortage of some seedlings, and that shortage could extend into springtime, particularly when a lot more gardeners, potential gardeners, come out and want their tomatoes and cucumbers and things like that as seedlings. And we'll talk to Michael Heine from the oldest garden centre in South Australia, Heine's Garden Centre, and we'll take a look at his wonderful, simple idea to make sure that you'll get your tomatoes and cucumbers and chilli plants when you want them in springtime.
Time for us to talk to Darren Ray, independent climatologist, who we talk to every month and gives us a great three-month weather outlook for what we can expect.
Good morning, Darren.
Yeah, hi, Susie. Hi, John. Nice to be here talking to you both.
There's been a lot of cloud during June, and also if we take a look at the rainfall, 30 millimetres more than average. Is there a reason why it's been so cloudy and so wet?
Yeah, it's certainly people might be feeling that bit of winter gloom, lots of cloud around, and obviously that a fair bit of rainfall in the first week or so of the month, but then some quite regular cold, windy, wet rainfall events through the rest of the month as well. We did basically the cold frontal systems extended further north over southern Australia. So one measure of that is another acronym for us, the Southern Annular Mode, or SAM. So when SAM's negative, the cold fronts come further north. We saw a really big pulse of that happen right through really the first week of the month, and particularly strongly through the middle of the month. So lots and lots of cold frontal systems, lots of cloud, windy. So the wind speeds are actually quite a bit above the average as well. So that's all very typical for early or through the conditions you expect with the negative Indian Ocean dipole climate influence.
Apart from SAM being negative, which gives all those conditions you've just described, you've been talking for quite some time about the warm waters that are flowing from the Pacific across to the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean dipole. Could you just give us an update as to where we're with the Indian Ocean dipole going negative, which of course is a potential for increasing rainfall there?
Yeah, so similar sort of story that we were seeing last year, and I've been talking about that for a while, that we're going to see a repeat of it again this year, and if anything a little bit stronger than last year, and that's been very much the case. So have seen some warm water start to move off to northwest of Australia. It's moved across northern Australia from the Western Pacific, and that's starting to set up the start of the negative Indian Ocean dipole event. And the modelling suggesting that's just going to further enhance over the next few months. So as we go through July, August, September, that's only going to strengthen and set us up for that, as you mentioned, generally colder and wetter conditions as we go through the rest of winter and through spring.
When will the IOD negative reach its peak?
So it tends to have its peak impact in August, September, October. So this one looks, in the modelling, looks like it peaks in September. And as we saw a little bit last year, the impact of it can be moderated a bit by what's going on with the tropical activity and potentially even impacts, noticing some potential impacts from what's going on with the ozone levels in the atmosphere and So how much the cold fronts can move further north and link up with the moisture from the off to the northwest of Australia. So can switch on and off a little bit. So it can get a little bit pulsy in terms of how it comes through. And it does look like September's looking particularly colder and wetter than average through this event.
All right. So September, will that be the wettest month?
The average rainfall in September is starting to come back a little bit from July. So, yeah, September's looking wetter than average, but the average for September is a touch below July. So, interestingly, for July, it does look like we're going to see a little bit of an off phase in terms of a fair bit of the month in terms of the everything linking together and triggering off more rainfall. So it does look like July rainfall actually would tend to be a little bit below average or near average rather than being wetter as we saw through June.
Oh, that's interesting. So when might it rain in July?
Yeah, more the end of the month, John, or the second half of the month, really. I guess the good news is this weekend's looking pretty reasonable for this time of year to be out gardening, which is great. There's a weak cold front coming through during the week, but not really a heap in it, and a little bit more at the end of the week. But it's really not picking up on that tropical moisture that much, and so it does look like this weekend, next weekend, will be pretty pleasant as well. But looks like the weekend after, looking at the modelling at that far, does look like there's a system coming through at the end of that week. So, yeah, the next two weekends look pretty good to be out in the garden.
So dry first half, wet in the second half. Is that wetness then going to flow into August?
Yeah, so it does look like it kicks off right at the end of August. So So it does look like there's a sequence of systems. So it goes more sequences of cold fronts coming through from about the 15th of the month of June. And then so we do get a sequence come through, and then it does look like it starts picking up again even more so right around the end of the month, and then through the first half of first half of August. So what you tend to see is a couple of weeks where it's wetter, a couple of weeks where it's a bit drier, that kind of thing pulsing on and off. And that's what I'm seeing in there, investigating into the modelling and the different models a bit. Is a bit of that sort of going on. So, so it looks like a bit of a pulse end of August, end of June, first half of August, and then it maybe switches off again a bit in the second half of August, then wets up again for late August through September.
August, early September, the show people mightn't be too happy if it's going to be wet then.
Yes.
That continue?
It'd be interesting to see what that happens, John, whether we pick a wet show this far ahead.
things can change, but I'm just looking at the concept of waves, though. You're sort of saying, okay, look, it'll be dry at the beginning of July, and then in comes the rain. That sort of wraps around to the beginning of August. It stays wet, and then it gets drier, and then by the time we get to September, or late August to September, it's wet again. So before we take a look at summer, if you don't mind, just the temperatures during winter, just very, very quickly, what's likely to happen?
Yeah, so, I mean, we've had a bit of a taste of that already through June. So warmer nights, warmer than average nights and colder days. So cloudy, windy. So that's, we're just really expecting more of the same through the next sort of 3 or 4 months. With the odd burst of sort of nice weather poking in there when things sort of ease off a little bit. So colder nights, probably days that colder days and nights that are perhaps around average or maybe slightly warmer than average with lots of cloud and winds around. So frost risk is generally a bit lower, but not completely, doesn't completely go away, but with sort of masses of cold air around, but in general, the amount of frost is going to be lower than usual over the next few months. And, rainfall, looking July, sort of something around about 50 millimetres in a total. August, around about 60-something. And September, around about 60 millimetres as well. So, and then October, a little bit drier. So, it does look like over the next few months we'll end up with... I'm thinking for winter rainfall, probably touch above the average, But August, September, August, October's looking maybe around about 180 millimetres, something like that, through August, September, October. And spring, about 10% wetter than average, so around about 140 millimetres as well. So just tending above average with rainfall and, coming in those sort of bursts a bit on and off. But September's looking, cold, wet. The Bureau's just declared the La Niña event we were in has gone back to neutral. Big question then is, will it reform? And we've got sort of 4 out of 7 models are saying, it'll go back into neutral sometime towards the end of the year, perhaps during November or December.
What does the Darren Ray model say?
I look at the majority of those models, the ocean's going to stay looking very La Niña. So I guess the news for gardeners, John, is we're looking at another relatively mild summer, at least for the first half, and so low heatwave risk. And but at the same time, and also things not warming up quickly. So you mentioned sort of the timing of coming into early spring and the start of the tomato planting season, what that might look like.
Do you think that we're going to have a delayed start to the tomato planting season?
It's looking likely to be a bit of a later start. And I mentioned last year's a good guide, so things were a little bit later last year. Yeah, it's looking very much a repeat of that.
I reckon that's a beaut kind of a forecast. We've got lots of moisture. The soil profile is wetting up, and then comes spring. Okay, it might be a little bit late, but it's the fear and the concern about heat waves. And if we're going to have a summer, which is be like last year or the year before, it's been just that mild without the heat waves and the damage that it causes. And I think there'll be a lot of gardeners very, very happy with what you're saying.
I will mention, John, I mean, just as I was coming on, I did hear that discussion about, sort of flood risk and rain and, rain and the impacts of that. It certainly has been dry, but things have wetted up and there is some significant rainfall on the cards over the next few months. So in general, it is a year when flood risk is, you'd anticipate that to be a bit higher than usual. So, it's a good message in there for people to make sure they keep their gutters clean and, the drainage all sorted and all that sort of stuff. So, it does look like it could get particularly wet through, as I mentioned, through September.
All right, that's wonderful information. And if you don't mind, I'll just do a little pricey for that for next week's Good Gardening newsletter.
Okay, thanks, John.
Okay, let's have a look at Jeremy's issue. Hello, Jeremy. You have a privet hedge, which may be dying.
Thanks a lot, Susie, and hello, John. Yeah, I've got two well-established privet hedges. They're both quite large. Due to landscaping reasons, I had to prune them back in the warmer months, which I know is not ideal. One's looking fine. The other one is looking quite poorly in terms of the colouring of the leaves and their vigour. I'm just wondering, John, is there anything I can do to help to revitalise it or put it on life support?
Don't do it too much at the moment. I need to go back and ask, when you were landscaping, did the landscaping come close to the hedge and damage the root system?
It didn't damage the root system, no. So that would all be intact and be quite large.
And the building type people haven't sort of put all their rubbish underneath your privet hedge?
No, and I confess I was the landscaper, the amateur okay. landscaper. But no, there was no debris or anything like that. So there's no damage to the soil or no compression of the soil either.
Yes, I'm a bit cynical. I've seen too many painters and plasterers get rid of their rubbish rather than having to pay to get rid of it. But we come back to your problem. I think privets, the bushes are extremely tough. I just wonder why it's not responding. At what time was it cut back?
Late summer, early autumn.
Being a privet, I would be very surprised if it doesn't respond in springtime. At this stage, I'd be getting a bag of cow manure or something soft, an organic fertiliser that's soft, and put the whole bag of cow manure out there. You can't do much harm with cow manure. But what that does is it breaks down and it gets worked into the top 2 or 3 centimetres of soil. as the rain washes it into the soil, and that will stimulate the microorganisms, and the little microorganisms will get the nutrients into a form that the plant roots can absorb, and it should be all systems go in springtime. And put gypsum on at 1 kilogram to the square metre, so you can work out how many kilograms you need. You can buy it by the 20 or 30 kilogram bag, and mix the cow manure and the gypsum together, and you'll find that's brilliant in changing the whole concept of your soil underneath your hedge.
Hopefully that helps, Jeremy.
If you want something to do, go to your garden centre and buy a bag of quality cow manure. And if you've got lots and lots of containers, put a layer, you know, a 2 or 3 centimetre layer of cow manure onto your containers, just on the top, and let nature work it away. You don't need gypsum for potting mix for plants in containers, but the cow manure will just moulder away during winter and really stimulate the little microorganisms, and I think you'll be surprised at the benefit of that simple little act.
Now, Jenny has bees in her roof. Hello, Jenny.
Yes, I had an electrician in my home on Thursday, and when she came down from the roof space, she said, "Jenny, you have bees up there. They're very dormant, but a couple of them landed on me. So I don't know who to call about this."
Call your council. They won't do it for you, but they
right.
should have a list of bees or bee operators, people that will actually, some of them will actually come and they will extract the hive from
right.
there and take it right. off and plonk it somewhere else. But if it's in a situation where they can't extract the bee population, then they will exterminate them for you.
Thank you for your help.
Varroa mite has been identified in New South Wales.
Yes. It's frightening, isn't it? Because that's very, very destructive on bee populations overseas. And we had none here in Australia.
Australia, up until now, has had the healthiest population of bees in the world. And the fact that there's been bee decline, I know there's been a lot of focus on chemicals, and chemicals have been blamed. It's not the chemicals that have been the problem. They are a contributor, but it is the varroa mite. United States, Europe, and certainly New Zealand all have varroa mite, and their population has been decimated.
Mm.
Australia, up until now, hasn't had varroa mite, and we have the healthiest bees in the world.
Mm.
And it is just so devastating, the fact that it's been found here in Australia. And if you want to look after the bees, put the chemicals to one side and get involved in supporting those that want to make sure that they eliminate varroa mite from Australia. If they don't, we're in big trouble.
Yes, fingers crossed they get on top of it very quickly. And everyone is treating it very seriously around that Newcastle area. So, yeah, good
yes.
luck to that, because it's a terrible thing.
9 outbreaks they've found so far.
Oh, dearie dear. Good morning, Jennifer. You have good a morning. Cane fern.
It's got long, strappy leaves.
Tell us about the squishy white dots.
They're a bit bigger than a pinhead, white, domed, and when they squish to a light brown, and they've just suddenly appeared.
Right, oh, well, we can call them by their common names, and they're just mealybugs. Mealybugs.
Oh, right, mealybugs.
A variation of a mealybug. I was looking for the phrase indoor. You're using it indoor. Mealybugs are a problem when you get an enclosed area. You might have it on a veranda, and there's not much wind movement, but and often in the outdoors, you don't have a problem with mealybugs simply because there are so many little parasites and predators that clean them up. But indoors, there's no little predators out there or in there.
No.
So you need to do something. Get a fork or something like that and just dig about a centimetre around the crown of the plant and just see whether they're congregated around there. Because often you'll find that they're in the soil, so you spray the surface the foliage, and then a couple of weeks later, there's more of them appear, and you say, "Oh, the chemical didn't work," but it's because you've sprayed the ones that you can see, and the ones that you can't see, just have a second go at the plant. There are a number of chemicals which are effective. One of the most effective, of course, is the one that a lot of people don't like me talking about, is Confidor, imidacloprid. You don't have bees inside, and so you can buy it as Confidor, you can buy it as imidacloprid. There are a number of chemical companies now that have gone back to selling that particular product. And if it's used according to the directions where you're not putting the bees at threat, then I think it's a very effective chemical because it's systemic. So I would be using Confidor. If you don't want to use that, then I'd be using one of the potassium sprays we were talking about earlier on. You just spray what you can see, but also drench some of that chemical into the root system around the crown of the plant. And if there's some down there, that will bowl those over as well.
Right. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. Yes, I have had times with indoor plants with severe mealybug infestations where I've just decided to throw the plant out so that it doesn't spread everywhere else. And no, put them in the compost, put it into the green bin because, yeah, they spread as well. They're horrible. Let's go to Keith now in Strathalbyn. What are the drawbacks of using horse manure? Keith wants to know. Hello, Keith.
Hello, how are you? What are the benefits and drawbacks of using horse manure?
Horse manure is a very good, what I call a pioneer fertiliser. When you've moved into a garden and there's not been a garden there and the soil is crummy, the best thing you can do is get horse manure. It's a lovely combination of lots of straw, and I'm presuming it's out of a stable. It's a lovely combination of straw and nutrients from the horse. And they combine together and give you a lovely material that gets worked into the soil, and the little microbes love it. And so it's very good from that point of view. If it's fresh, you've got the smell, that's a downsize. If it's aged, then that's not so bad, but it doesn't have as much nitrogen in it. So if you're using fresh horse manure, you would only use that on bare soil. You wouldn't use it on where there's plants already growing. If it's aged, well, then you can put it into the compost. The one thing that you need to watch out for is if it's from a stable and it's relatively fresh, you need to ask the people where you get it from what kind of chemicals they're using. Many of them use chemicals to control worms in the horse. So if you're buying fresh horse manure from a stable, age it.
I don't buy it, John. I get it free from the from the race course up here.
Okay, well, so it's just inquiry as to sort of what kind of chemicals that go down the horse's mouth and come out the other end, because that's what you're using. But you'll find that either composting or leaving it in a heap for quite some time will overcome any downside.
Thanks, John.
Aldina at Dernancourt is with us now with a question about something in the newsletter. Hello, Aldina.
I happened to read the newsletter that came out yesterday, and references made to Dalac saber tooth folding saw. I was wondering where I could purchase it from. I've made initial inquiries to a couple of outlets, but they don't have it.
Well, the important thing is if you go onto the web and dial in Mr. Fothergill's.
Okay.
It's an interesting company, and they have bought up one of the major gardening tool companies in the UK, and they're bringing them out here into Australia. And they are very, very concerned that they use ergonomic tools, and it's the quality of them, so you've got to be prepared to pay for them. But you'll find that they have an amazing range of garden tools, things that are not readily available from garden centres, but certainly online.
Sometimes suppliers will actually say where you can buy things. You know, retail outlets, you can search for Adelaide and find where they are, or you can send them an email and say, where are you stocking this, and even tell them where you are, and that might help you find out where it is if you don't want to buy things online. And George of Marlston is saying horse manure can be contaminated with broadleaf herbicides, so that's probably something else that you need to be aware of as well.
There is a particular chemical that's used to control your legumes, and that is not the kind of chemical you want to go putting in the garden, because it'll stop everything from growing.
And so, it stays around for quite a long time, I believe, as well. Yes, so you do need to be aware of the source.
Talkback Gardening
with John Lamb
and Susie Ramone
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
And it's good morning now to Michael Heine from Heine's Garden Centre on the Parade in Norwood. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Let's take a look at the situation now. I think many gardeners, or many people with gardens, are trying to beat spiralling vegetable prices by growing their own vegetables. And, of course, there's been a rush on lettuce and some other leafy type of things, and there's a shortage, of some of the seedlings there. And the big concern is what's going to happen in springtime, when a lot of people who are currently hibernating get out there and want to put in their chilies and their tomatoes and things like that. Michael, I mean, as manager of one of our larger and older garden centres, how do you see the situation at the moment? Is it a flash in the pan, or is it going to be ongoing?
Look, I don't think it'll be the same mayhem we had when COVID was on, but I think there will definitely be some pressure on some of the seedlings, especially early spring, things like tomatoes and cucumbers and all the most popular things, and probably the most likely things that will have a high price on them this spring will probably be the main target early on.
How are you going to overcome the problem? You're known within the industry for being very innovative, and there is concern that there may not be sufficient number of tomatoes or cucumbers or chilies or whatever it is in that September period. So what are you doing about it to make sure that those gardeners that want their veggies then, or their seedlings then, will make sure that they're available?
We're actually going to take pre-orders. So as of yesterday, we started taking pre-orders for our full spring-summer vegetable line. You can come in store and pick up the form and just fill it in and email or drop it back in, or you can download one from our website.
And presumably, it's not just a matter of you getting your customers to fill in the form. You've already spoken to the production nurseries to make sure that's going to happen.
We'll just keep in touch with the production nurseries that we deal with. And once, if we start getting numbers building up quite quickly, we'll pass that information on to them, and they'll be able to up their production if needed to counter what we will pull from their system.
Earlier in the program, we were talking to Darren Ray, and he was suggesting spring might be late. So instead of people saying, well, I normally put my tomatoes in the first week in October, it may be that's not the soil is not warm enough to put your tomatoes in. How can you get around that one?
Well, you always get that early rush when you get that first warm day in like late August or early September, and everyone's wanting basil and tomatoes and pumpkins. But we're kind of trying to advise people to, you know, there's no rush, and the October long weekend's probably the best weekend to start putting those varieties in. But early on, you can get all those leafy vegetables in, like your silver beets and broccoli and small hybrid cabbages. And maybe if, you know, people can hold off on tomatoes and basils till you get to around October.
Would you say that some gardeners are planting their summer vegetables too early?
Oh, that's definitely the case. I mean, you know, last season in particular, we had people coming in at the end of July wanting chilies and basil. And the problem is if you do put some of those things in too early with that cold weather and damp soil that you still have early in the season, you know, those seedlings have got a great chance of rotting off, or if not, taking off very slowly. So it is best to wait till it just warms up a bit.
During COVID, if you wanted toilet rolls, they weren't available. Now they are available, and they've increased the price. What's the likelihood the garden centres will increase the price of veggies because they're short?
No garden centres will put prices up on vegetables based on demand. You know, any price rises that come around for product in our industry is based on, you know, the cost of producing it.
And just a quickie, are you short of any seedlings at the moment? Lettuce?
No, we're pretty good at the moment. We're pretty well stocked. We've got plenty of lettuce.
Thank you so much for that. And it is a really good idea, and hopefully other nurseries will take that on board as well. And you can always go into your garden centre and ask them, your local garden centre, and just say, will you order for me a particular type of tomato seedlings or that kind of thing. So Michael Heine, fifth generation garden centre manager. That's amazing, really. Congratulations to your family. Thank you. Kathy from Spalding.
We have access to bags of coffee grounds and ash from wood fires.
All right.
How good are they for the garden?
Well, coffee's good, ash is not. Do you make your own compost?
Yes.
Right. Oh, well, I'd suggest you put the coffee grounds into the compost. If you put lots of coffee ground on in a particular spot, that's not good. You get you don't have a balance of nutrients and materials in the ground. But if you put it into the compost heap and say, right, I'll have no more than, say, 20% coffee grounds, and the rest can be straw and weeds and things like that, you'll end up with some pretty good kind of compost. If you wanted to put it onto the garden, that's okay. Just put it thinly, no more than, say, a centimetre depth of the material, and you'll find that this time of the year it'll get worked into the topsoil pretty quickly. As for the ash, don't do it. Spalding, I suspect you've got very alkaline soil right through that area, and ash also is very alkaline. The best thing you can do is consign your ash. Do you get a green waste bin go past your door, or do you have to dispose of it yourself?
I dispose of it myself.
Righto. Well, listen, find an out-of-the-way spot in maybe in your garden or wherever, and dig a great big hole and just fill it up with the ash. And it's of no significant value from a gardening point of view, but there's a lot of downsides. So don't use it on the garden. Your alkaline soil will become even more alkaline. And when that happens, a lot of the nutrients which are available to the plant or essential to the plant are just not available. So don't do it.
John, I just want to mention that you've brought me in a lovely gift this morning, which is a beautiful camellia flower with sort of deep red at the start of the petals, grading out to white or palish pink at the edges, and very, very full and fluffy. What is that?
That's
lovely?
Volunteer. It's one of the newer camellias, and it's a beautiful kind of a camellia to have in a garden. It only grows probably 2 metres tall. I've got a couple of them, and they sort of grew quite quickly, and once they reached their 2 metres height, they stopped growing, and of course they produce lots of little side branches, and I've got two bushes, and they are just absolutely plastered. There would have been probably well over 100 buds. They're just starting to open up now, and as you mentioned, it's a very full. It's like an old-fashioned rose. Remember, the old-fashioned rose is cup-shaped and lots of petals, and there's lots of little mini little flowers inside the main flower. But it's the colour combination. I think it's very nice. But the thing is, it's called volunteer for a reason. And when the plants are sold, a certain amount of the funds that are come from that particular sale go to support volunteer organisations. It's a lovely idea.
Let's go to Murray Bridge now, and Jane has broad beans growing. Hello, Jane.
John, I planted in a tub thing. I planted my broad beans probably about a month or more ago, and they've grown beautifully. And they're very tall and very green and very lush and flowers, but I haven't had one broad bean. And last year I did the same thing, and I had lots of broad beans, and this year I have none.
Broad beans need pollination by bees. Bees are not too happy when temperatures get pretty low, and they're
right.
Even less happy when it's showery. So you could blame the weather on the fact that they're not very active, and when the temperatures get down around about 11 or 12 degrees, the bees aren't very, very active. And that's why a lot of people don't put their broad beans in until later in the season, and they start to sort of flower around about now, and or a little bit, even a little bit later. I've gone into this in a fair amount of depth. There's, I mean, some tremendously interesting research carried out by Sardi and the researchers there. And the role of the bee is tremendously important in that pollination. Now, what often happens is people want to get maximum production, and so they put their bean seeds a little bit closer together than is recommended. And what happens is you get this lovely plant, but it's all leaves. Along comes a bee, and the plants are starting to produce their flowers from the bottom. They start at the bottom. The flowers are down there, but the bees can't get them. So if you want to grow broad beans, rather than putting them close together, put them further apart.
How far apart do you think?
Well, at least 20 centimetres and even further between the rows. But you'll find that if you're planting early, you'll get vigorous growth and then you'll get a lot of stooling out, so you'll have a number of branches. So I'd be putting them even, for early broad beans, have them about 30 centimetres apart. You might need little strings or something like that to hold them up, or else grow dwarf broad beans and space them well apart. That allows the bees to come in, and the bees will work if it's not showery, and certainly so long as it's reasonably warm. And we get enough warm days and enough dry days for the bees to give you good production from your broad beans, even if you plant them early.
Well, patience, Jane. Hopefully the bees will still come, and keep planting flowers, everyone, because that helps. You know, if you can find things that are flowering now, that helps the bees. One last question to squeeze in before we finish up Talk About Gardening. We've got Sally at Seaford with the Chinese star jasmine. Can she put it in the ground now or keep it in the pot? Good question, Sally. Hello.
Oh, hello. Look, I hope I've bought the right one. I wanted the one, the jasmine that has beautiful perfume. Anyway, the one I've bought is the Chinese star. And I need to know, will it sulk if I put it in the ground now?
Don't leave it in the pot. Star jasmine are lovely plants, but they are very slow to get going, and they don't particularly like cold, wet soil. So a good case of doing nothing, I like saying that in Talk About Gardening at this time of the year, do nothing, hold it in your container, put it somewhere where it's out of the wind, gets plenty of sunshine, don't let it dry out, but don't let it get too wet, and I'd be waiting until it's time to plant your tomatoes. Probably end of September, early October, plant it out then, and you'll find it'll take off straight away without any check. Put it in the ground now, sit there, sulk, you may lose half the root system, and you'll set it back considerably.
Thank you, John. That brings us to the end of our time for Talk About Gardening. Anything you quickly wanted to say before the end?
I think it's a good time just to check your garden plants out in the container just to make sure the drainage is working properly well. I think there's a lot more rain to come our way. It's beautiful working with you, Susie.
You too, John.
Love your comments. And until next week, good gardening.